This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm John Hodge, joined by the cheese, J.C. Abbott. Justin Dunk will be back next week. Today, we're discussing the Toronto Argonauts signing former CFL All-Star return man, Jenarian Grant.
The BC Lions cutting a former first-round CFL draft pick.
The ongoing race to see who will be Saskatchewan's backup quarterback.
The Hamilton Tiger Cats signing former Most Outstanding Canadian Award nominee, David Menard.
Johnny Manziel opening up about his one-year tenure in the CFL.
And the Lions booking another major music artist for their home opener. But first,
JC, we just had a super CFL preseason Saturday with four games taking place across the country. As our resident BC Lions writer, you obviously paid closest attention to the game between BC and Calgary, though there was plenty of other action to be had with the Alouettes topping the Argonauts, the Red Blacks beating the Ticats, and the Riders besting the Elks. What was your biggest takeaway from the four games? What are you most looking forward to on Friday for its four-game slate?
Well, as you mentioned, Hodge, I was paying close attention to the game that I had to write off of. And my biggest takeaway from that game, although it was very hard to glean very much of anything from that particular contest, given the fact that the Lions, as they have the last number of years, have taken a skeleton crew on the road, two preseason games, basically regular roster size, but with all of their depth players, many of whom are going to end up being cut and not making the roster. Even with that poor talent level around them, I was unimpressed by the quarterback play for the BC Lions. All the guys who are supposed to be the insurance policy in behind Vernon Adams Jr., Jake Dolagala goes out there in his first game as a Lion. I believe he was 1 for 8 in that game for 8 yards. And yeah, there was a drop here. The offensive line wasn't very good, but he looked nervous in the pocket. I thought his delivery was off. There was a couple of balls where he was very nearly picked, I thought. The read was just a step too late. And all of his delivery was way too high. He did not look comfortable. He did not look like a guy who can come in and be the insurance policy. Now, we have game tape on Dolagala. We saw what he did last year in Saskatchewan. He was fine down the stretch for that team. But it's clear to me that the BC Lions don't have the same quarterback room they did a year ago when Dane Evans was the guy behind Vernon Adams Jr. And they had arguably the best quarterbacking situation in the league with a starting caliber backup. Jake Dolagala is not that guy. Dakota Prukop, who was supposed to be the third stringer, was cut after this game. And Chase Bryce, who looked fine in a half of action against the Stampeders backups, is inexperienced as the third stringer. And it also seems like the Lions have decided the answer to their short yardage woes is to get VA to run the short yardage plunge for all of this season. To me, that's concerning. That's extra hits on your starting quarterback when you don't have a good insurance policy in behind. I was not very pleased with that aspect of the Lions game.
I think you're underselling the performance of Caleb Brace a little bit. Yes, he played while the Stamps were running their backup crew, while Jake Dolagala was playing most of Calgary's defensive starters, but 10 of 16 for 128 yards in what was really his first CFL action, I thought was more than solid. I also thought that a couple of other young quarterbacks, Dustin Crum, I thought looked really good in Ottawa's win over the Hamilton Tiger Cats. I also thought that Caleb Evans shone in Montreal's win over the Toronto Argonauts. And again, a lot of that comes in the later stages of the game when You're playing against a bunch of guys who are going to get cut. But the other side of that argument to me is always, well, but you're playing alongside guys who are probably going to get cut or be practice roster guys, right? If you're playing against backups with backups, I think that evens the playing field a lot. Evan's touchdown pass, by the way, if you missed it, he found, I believe it was Jose Barbone in the back of the end. It might have been Kayon Julian Grant. I can't remember. He found a receiver in the back.
I don't think Jose Barbone's even on a roster this year. You're on the preseason year.
It's a different Barbone. I'll have to fact check myself after the show. But regardless, Caleb Evans, absolutely sensational touchdown pass. If you haven't checked out that replay, please make sure that you do so. So far, the best play I've seen in preseason action. I was a little bit surprised. And by the way, I caught almost all of these games bouncing back and forth between them. Full credit to the league for CFL Plus holding up, even though four games were happening at the same time. And as I should say, we ripped the CFL for its awful stats during the first preseason game of this season between the Saskatchewan Roughriders, Winnipeg Blue Bombers. The CFL's connect window for media for stats worked really well in week two. So I want to give them full credit. The stats seem to be consistent. Unlike the first game, the scores were all correct, and the stats seem to be finalized on CFL.ca for fans and media really quickly. So I want to give them credit for that. Is that a high bar? No, it should be taken for granted that a league can produce stats. But I think we should give them at least some benefit for getting it right with four games taking place simultaneously, or maybe not all simultaneously, but you know what I mean? Four taking place in quick succession, including, I think it was, there was an hour there where three games were happening at once. I had multiple screens going. I was a little bit surprised Taylor Powell didn't look better playing against what was a number of backups from the Ottawa Redblacks. But my biggest takeaway is the fact that the Edmonton Elks appear to be unbelievably cursed. Like, holy smokes, they outplayed the Saskatchewan Roughriders to a almost shocking degree. Net offense in this one, 411 yards for the Elks, 191 for the Riders. The Elks only took two penalties for 10 yards. Like, when you are outgaining your opponents almost at, well, by the way, they also sacked Saskatchewan's quarterbacks four times, allowed zero sacks themselves. Like, this should have been a 25 or 30 point win as the Riders sent a skeleton crew to Commonwealth Stadium. But instead, McLeod Bethel Thompson has a pass go off the hands of Eugene Lewis. It bounces awkwardly up into the air, gets returned for a pick six. We also saw Javon Leak, Edmonton's star return specialist, reigning most outstanding special teams player, have a punt go through his hands at the goal line. Kosi Onyeka caught it for a touchdown. It was a shocking result for a team that should have won this game. And normally, under any other circumstance, you'd shrug and you'd go, okay, whatever, it's preseason. This type of stuff happens. But after the last few seasons that the Edmonton Elks have had, I don't blame any fans in that city who are going, holy smokes, here we go again. It literally does not matter who we sign, what we do. This team is just snake bitten. Somebody has a Chris Jones voodoo doll out there and is poking it mercilessly with all kinds of sharp implements. Like, holy smokes, what a stunning result, because this team should have won this game. No question.
Let's make something clear, Hodge. I think there are a few people around the CFL, past and maybe present, who have Chris Jones voodoo dolls.
Yeah, probably.
Sticking in the closet. What was shocking to me about these turnovers, you expect that sloppiness in preseason, but you don't necessarily expect it from the starters. And of those, I believe it was five turnovers from Edmonton. I think four came while the starting group was out there for the team, and it resulted in total in 24 points against. You talk about the difference in terms of yardage for the two sides. Well, when you're committing turnovers in your own end and giving away points as a result, the other offense doesn't have to gain very many yards to put up points and to beat you. So they handed this game away with a unit that should know better. Now, I think it was bad puck luck, if you want to use that term, on some of the turnovers here. The McLeod Bethel Thompson interception wasn't really his fault. He threw it into bad coverage. So you can write those things off. But as you said, this is a team that maybe hasn't earned the benefit of the doubt that you have a lot of questions about going in and are relying on that first team offense and upgraded special teams to compensate for what is a very inexperienced defense with a lot of question marks on it. Well, both of those sides were the ones who were giving away the points in this one. That has to be concerning.
The interception from McLeod Bethel-Thompson made me think of something I've wanted every professional league to do for a long time now, which is differentiate between, you know, what might maybe would be called a true interception and an at-fault interception or an incidental interception. This would have been an incidental interception, right? When you read on social media, oh, McLeod Bethel-Thompson picked six, you go, oh, did he wait 3 seconds, then try to throw that field side out that, you know, most rookie CFL quarterbacks try to make, and it gets taken back for a touchdown? No, this was not a mental error. This was just a bad bounce. And I think it's unfair sometimes that we charge quarterbacks with interceptions on throws that, you know, are quite literally just bad luck with the way that the ball bounces off the receiver. We've also seen lots of circumstances, right, where the ball literally hits a receiver in the hands and, you know, they take a hit, the ball bounces back up and it gets picked. Like, that is not the fault of a quarterback, but I digress. To get to the second part of the question, which is which game I'm most excited for. I'm obviously excited for the Calgary-Winnipeg game because I will get to be there in person at the newly dubbed Princess Auto Stadium on Friday. But the game I'm perhaps more excited for that I will be watching back on CFL Plus the following day is Montreal at Ottawa. And the reason is I was very interested to see what the Red Blacks would be doing with 2023 CFL first overall draft pick Dante Bull, who they've kind of touted as a potential starter there. He did make a number of starts last season, coming off the broken leg that he suffered during his final collegiate season at Fresno State. And JC, I was waiting. I felt like a jilted lover waiting at home while my date made me wait endlessly at the door to be picked up. And lo and behold, finally with 4 minutes left, 4 minutes left in the game. And keep in mind, the Red Blacks were on the road here, which means that they didn't bring a lot of their starters. Like, it was a skeleton crew. Even on a skeleton crew, they gave Dante Bull 4 minutes to play right tackle. And he went out there with a ton of energy, and he was running up and down the field, looking tenacious. But to me, actions have always and will always speak louder than words. And the Red Blacks can say what they want to say about believing in Dante Bull, but when you're sitting a guy for 56 minutes in a preseason game, as a guy who has started in this league and is a first overall pick, that tells me you don't have a lot of faith in what he can do. So I'm interested to see if that changes course. Did the Red Blacks see something on film from game one that can translate to game two? Because that was a very challenging spot for them at right tackle last season. They need to provide Drew Brown with better protection. And they obviously used a lot of draft capital to take Dante Bull. So I want to see the status of Dante Bull next week when they host the Alouettes.
I think that's a fascinating storyline to watch there. I'm intrigued to see who's got the leg up in some of the starting receiver battles around the league, because there's a number of teams that are going to have one or two either first or second year players step into their starting lineups for at least week one and potentially into the future. Obviously, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers have a hole in their receiving core right now. The Hamilton Tiger Cats do as well. I think Shamar Bridges, in his first preseason performance, sort of cemented himself as a guy who's going to be in that starting lineup. They've now brought in Stephen Dunbar Jr., who is going to probably start in the other spot that was open there. But the BC Lions have two starting receiver spots that are presumably going to go to Aiden Eberhardt, who was a preseason darling last year, and Travis Fulham, who was an NFL undrafted sort of cult star for a season with the Philadelphia Eagles and then wasn't afforded the opportunities after that. He's looked really good in camp by all accounts, but because the Lions decided to only bring two starters to that first preseason game, we didn't see either Eberhardt or Fulham, neither of whom are bona fide entrenched CFL names that we know what we're going to get from them. So that's a big burden to place on one preseason game to have those two guys run with the first team offense for the first time. I'm really interested to see how they look with Vernon Adams Jr., because if they don't live up to the expectations, perhaps that's a big hit in a Lions receiving core that just a year ago was, I think, indisputably the best in the league.
I have fact-checked myself, and the receiver in question is, in fact, Jose Barbone. Take that, JC.
I thought he was last year.
You're sipping coffee. I'm going to be sipping tea right here because I just won. I am vindicated. Let's go. All right. Moving on. Vegas has set its over-under win totals for teams across the CFL, and they are as follows. BC, 11.5. Calgary, 7.5. Edmonton, 6.5. Saskatchewan, 7.5. Winnipeg, 12.5. Hamilton, 8.5. Toronto, 9.5. Ottawa, 6.5, and Montreal, 10.5. We will have all these up, by the way, at 3downnation.com as of Thursday morning. And for the uninitiated, an over-under essentially means you can bet on whether a team will surpass this win total or fail to reach this win total. We'll use the BC Lions as an example. At 11.5, if they win 11 or fewer games and you bet the under, you win money. If they win more than 11 games and you bet on the over, you win money. And if, of course, you go the other way, then you lose money. JC, of these nine lines, which one seems like the best bet to you?
You know, I think Vegas got these lines mostly right. There isn't anything here that jumps out as necessarily egregious to me. I will skew positive, and I'll go betting the over on the Ottawa Redblacks at 6.5. Not because I think this is a team that is going to necessarily compete for a Grey Cup or blow everybody's expectations out of the water. But I think they're an improved squad. I think if Drew Brown lives up to what we've all seen from him in limited minutes in Winnipeg, he is going to improve that team. They've got Dominic Rhymes in the receiving core now. I think that is a huge boost for them on defense. You've got a good pass rush, and then guys like Adarius Pickett, who are legitimate stars in this league, they're going to be improved, and the rest of the East Division, in my mind, isn't necessarily going to take a big jump. I think Toronto is inevitably going to be worse, even if they're able to overcome most of what they'll be limited by with the Chad Kelly suspension. I am not convinced that Hamilton is going to take a big step this year. I thought they needed to do more in the offseason. And Montreal, the reigning Grey Cup champions, aren't necessarily a team you look at and say, okay, they're going to run away with this and put up 14 wins or something ridiculous like that. There will be games to steal in that East Division. I think Ottawa ends up being the team that steals them to get in the 8 or 9 win range.
I think Ottawa is a shrewd pick. Now, we never commiserate on these type of things, so that was one that did jump out to me as well. I didn't know who you were going to take. One that I will take that I think is one to look at is the Toronto Argonauts over 9.5 wins. I mean, this is a team that, let's not forget, yes, I know the Chad Kelly situation, obviously. Cameron Duke's unproven. But since Ryan Dinwiddie became this team's head coach, they have finished first in the East Division, not once, not twice, but 3 consecutive years. And they've reached, 2021 was a little bit of a different case because there was only 14 regular season games. But they went 9-5 that season, winning almost twice as many games as they lost. They won 11 games in 2022, and they won 16 games in 2023. And it hasn't mattered who this team's starting quarterback has been. They've had some success with Nick Arbuckle. They've had success with McLeod Bethel-Thompson. And they had success with Chad Kelly. And this team's, you know, playing in the East, I think, is always a little bit easier than playing in the West, as you mentioned, with the Ottawa Redblacks. I don't think that the Argonauts have it in them to win 16 games like they did last season. But even taking Chad Kelly out of the equation, even taking some of the stars, yeah, they don't have Curley Gittens Jr. anymore. They lost to Darius Pickett. They lost Javon Leak. Well, guess what? They've made some exciting additions, like Jake Ceresna playing on that defensive line with guys like Falara Arimolade, with guys like Robbie Smith, who I think is criminally underrated. Like, that unit is going to... Jared Brinkman is also underrated on that unit. Sean Oakman is an all-star player. Like, this unit, I think, is going to be exceptional. Yes, they're going to miss Corey Mace calling the plays on defense, but they're also in a position where their two incumbents, who are kind of the co-defensive coordinators of that unit, I think are in a great position to just keep a good thing going, right? These guys already know this system. So I'm not suggesting, again, that the Argonauts are going to win 16 games again. I'm not even suggesting they're going to win the East, because I think the Alouettes right now would probably be the favorite to do so. They do have the highest win total over under, but their over under is only one game higher than the Argonauts as the defending Grey Cup champions, who have essentially kept the same roster from 2023. The Argonauts look very different, but I certainly think this team can go 10-8. I still think they can go 11-7. And I think there's some potential there for sure.
I'll push back on you a little bit there, Hodge. I don't love the Toronto number. And to me, it has less to do with the time that Chad Kelly is going to miss, but potentially what it looks like when he comes back as well. Because I think it's undeniable that they're going to lose a few games with either Cameron Dukes or Nick Arbuckle, whoever ends up being at the helm for the most of that 9-game stretch for the Argos. But even if they're 5-4 or something of that nature, when Kelly comes back, what has this done to that locker room? Because we've all heard the whispers. I don't think Kelly is overly well liked in that Argos team even before this incident. Now he's actively hurt the team by being away. There's a potential that they're going to get attached to a new quarterback. If Cameron Dukes is a better locker room guy and all of a sudden shows some flashes, well, maybe we don't need that other guy, right? Being able to win matters a whole lot in pro football. Talent matters a whole lot, but there are other things that matter as well. And I wonder if this team is going to be as galvanized as they have been in the past, or if there are going to be some cracks that show if and when Chad Kelly comes back to the fold. So I would lay off the Toronto Argonauts for that reason. But the other line that we haven't talked about here that I think jumps out, Saskatchewan at 7.5. You talking about the effect that Corey Mace leaving the Argos might have. Yeah, that's going to create some changes on defense. I think his addition in Saskatchewan, as well as some of the players that they've added, that's a team that could be on the rise as opposed to just stealing wins. I think they're going to be a decisive third-place team in the West.
I do not hate the Saskatchewan pick. They do have to play the Bombers 3 times, but I agree they're going to be better this year. And if Trevor Harris stays healthy, it's hard to imagine that team not winning at least 8 games, one would think. So that's fair. I don't think your Argonauts argument makes any sense whatsoever. Essentially, your argument is, well, what if Cameron Dukes is great? Then it doesn't matter that Chad Kelly's coming back. Oh, well, guess what, JC? If Cameron Dukes is great, I think this team's going to win more than 9.5 games and hit the over here. I will also say this club has a bit of a back-loaded schedule, which I think favors them if, in fact, Chad Kelly returns after serving his 9-game suspension. The first 9 games of the season, they've got to play Winnipeg, but they get to host Winnipeg. They don't have to go to Winnipeg. They have Montreal twice, which is tough, and they open the season against the BC Lions. That being said, again, they get to host the BC Lions, which I think is a lot easier than having to travel all the way to Vancouver, especially considering that if they'd had to travel to Vancouver for the home opener, there'd be potentially 40,000+ fans there, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the show. During this time, they get Edmonton, they get Saskatchewan, they get Hamilton, and they get Calgary twice. And I think that, with all due respect to those teams, makes it a little bit easier for a guy like Cameron Dukes to tread water, if in fact he is treading water. The second half of the season is when they have to go to Winnipeg. The second half of the season is when they have to go to Vancouver. The second half of the season, they've got Montreal again. It's a little bit of a tougher schedule than the first half of the season. So I think that that potentially is going to be beneficial for that team, but remains to be seen.
I just don't bet on teams with internal strife. I don't know how it's going to affect that roster, and talent is only one phase of a team's culture and a team's result.
I get all that, but there have been some pretty darn good teams in the CFL where some people in those organizations openly despise each other.
Absolutely, but inevitably that always came to a head, and there was a decline after the fact. I think you could say that about the Argos last year, right? But now this has come to a head. Once it's bubbled to the surface, it's hard to tamp it back down.
I don't entirely disagree with you. That being said, I think it's pretty amazing that you can bet the over on the Argonauts and still hit it, even if they lose, even if they win six fewer games than they did a season ago. That seems like a good deal to me. But I also don't mind the over on the Riders. I don't mind the over on the Red Blacks, as you said. Something else I will say, I don't hate the under on the Bombers. And the reason for that is right now the juice that accompanies their line of 12.5, it's the highest of any team in the league, and rightfully so. The Bombers have been sensational, obviously, the last number of years. But with the juice of minus 135, like, you can make good money betting the under. And with some of the losses this club had, you want to talk about Janarian Grant, Jackson Jeffcoat, Jermarcus Hardrick, Rashid Bailey. You know, I could absolutely see the Bombers being a 12-win team. In fact, that is, on the record, my official prediction for the Bombers this season. Last year, I had them winning 13. This year, I have them winning 12. 12-6 is my prediction. But who knows? Maybe they'll win 15 games again. I'll have to wait and see.
The Saskatchewan Roughriders are the only team to have wrapped up their preseason following wins over the Winnipeg Blue Bombers and Edmonton Elks. One of the hotly debated topics in Riderville is about whether incumbent Mason Fine or journeyman Shea Patterson deserves to be the backup to Trevor Harris. Who gets your vote, Hodge?
I mean, my vote is for the player who can make plays with his feet and push the ball down the field, and that's Shea Patterson. I mean, this is a guy who was extremely highly touted coming out of the University of Michigan. He got an NFL opportunity. He has bounced around the CFL a little bit, previously being on rosters in BC and Montreal, but he's the same age as Mason Fine, right? And Mason Fine's tenure at the University of North Texas was defined by his ability to push the ball downfield. It's kind of this undersized, like, swashbuckling, big-armed quarterback. And that is not who he's been, right? He's now going into his fourth season in Riderville. I feel like if Mason Fine was going to happen, he would have happened by now. And I know Corey Mays told the media in Regina that he's undecided about who the backup will be. I'm personally skeptical as to whether or not I even believe what he's saying. I suspect Corey Mays has made up his mind. He's just not willing to reveal his decision at this point. But to me, the choice is pretty obvious. It's Shea Patterson. The only reason, in my opinion, you'd go for Mason Fine right now is because having Mason Fine as the number two to start the season, it's a lot easier to change to Shea Patterson later on than it is to do the reverse, right? If you start off with Mason Fine as the third stringer, which is lower than he started on the totem pole last year, you've probably destroyed his confidence. So if Fine is the backup in name to start the season, that wouldn't surprise me. But, I mean, come on, there's no argument. Shea Patterson has been the better player thus far through what we've seen from Saskatchewan.
Yeah, I actually disagree fundamentally with a lot of the takes on the Saskatchewan's backup QB situation. First of all,
this is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I think Mason Fine had a more difficult matchup in that second preseason game. We really didn't get to see him in the first week because of an undisclosed injury. They'd let him hand off a couple times, but they didn't let him throw. So let's throw out that first game. Obviously, Patterson came in. I think he was 3 for 3. He had a touchdown. It was a long touchdown to Ajo Ajo, the Canadian rookie receiver, but I don't think that was a touchdown that was that was Shea Patterson putting it on a rope in a dot to an area his receiver could get it.
He was facing the blitz, and it was a good throw.
It was a solid throw, but most of that yardage was after the catch, after a DB stumbled by his receiver, right? I'm not saying it's a bad throw. I'm just saying it's not the type of throw you go, okay, that's the guy. We can't forget these players' entire lives, their entire careers. Mason Fine has been a capable backup, a capable starter at times for the Riders. Is he going to blow your socks off? No, he's not going to blow your socks off. But the answer is not to go to another guy who hasn't really been a capable anything and is the same age. If you don't think Mason Fine is the guy, go and find a guy, right? Shea Patterson is not going to mystically become a guy he's never been in his entire career with multiple opportunities in different CFL cities with the USFL number one overall pick, right? He is not going to be that guy. And I'm going to call out our writer, Brendan McGuire, specifically here, because he put out his article in defense of Shea Patterson, and he hyped up Shea Patterson as having a much better college career than Mason Fine. And that's just bogus, okay? Yeah, he played at Ole Miss and Michigan at a capable level. That's great. Those are big-time programs. Mason Fine was electric at North Texas. Yeah, it's a small school, but he threw for like 4,000 more yards and 30 more touchdowns in his college career than Shea Patterson did. To me, that means something. He was the better prospect coming into the CFL. I think he's the more proven guy right now. And if you don't trust him, don't go with someone else who's the same age, who you still hasn't proven himself either. You go out and you find the next one. You see if Jack Cohen can be that guy. You see if somebody on your neg list can be that guy. If you don't want Mason Fine, don't recycle old guys that we've already seen haven't made that jump.
So your argument isn't so much that Mason Fine is good, it's that they're both not good.
Yeah. I think Mason Fine is fine. He hasn't been what I wanted him to be in the CFL. I think there may still be potential there, but I think Shea Patterson is not a better player right now. I don't think he has more developmental potential. And if Mason Fine isn't good enough for you, go out on the scouting trail and find yourself a new quarterback.
Fair enough. I will disagree, though, with the idea that Shea Patterson has had his opportunity. Yes, he's been on a couple of rosters, but he has thrown 6 career regular season pass attempts in the CFL versus Mason Fine, who has dressed for 32 games and thrown for almost 2,000 yards, right? He's attempted 247 passes, which is not a small sample size, not a huge sample size, but not a small sample size. Sure. His average depth of target, he's got a negative touchdown interception ratio, by the way, 6-8. And his average depth of target for his career is a measly 7.3 yards. For reference, Nick Arbuckle, who I believe you've dubbed King of the Checkdown, has an average of 7.8 yards.
I think you dubbed him. I didn't call him King of the Checkdown.
It's possible I called him that. But I do want to give Nick Arbuckle credit. He looked, for a guy who barely practiced, I thought he looked pretty good in the preseason outing that he had against the Montreal Alouettes. But my point is, Mason Fine is unwilling to take risks with the football. He is not able to make plays with his feet. And when you watch opposing defenses, I don't think they respect his ability to throw the deep ball whatsoever, because the defensive unit that he plays against, like I saw Mason Fine play live at the Halifax game this past season. Toronto was up, giving no space. They are stuffing the box. They are saying, hey, we're not going to let you run the ball against us. We're not going to give your receivers anything for free. We are going to clamp down on you. And the only way to get defenses to stop doing that is to prove that you could beat them long. Mason Fine failed to do that. He got sacked a ton of times, partly because his offensive line struggled, partly because he was holding onto the ball for too long. And then Jake Dolagala came in, slung a touchdown pass, and was the starter for the rest of the season. Like, that is how that went. I don't understand the any reason why Mason Fine would be the backup here. I'm not saying you got to cut him, but yeah, he did not do anything in the preseason.
Let's be frank. Corey Mace went in there. Mark Mueller went in there. And they evaluated this offseason. And they had the choice between bringing back Jake Dolagala and Mason Fine. And they chose Mason Fine because they thought he was better for their system. And that ability to hit the checkdowns. I mean, Mark Mueller's coming from Calgary. You want to talk about king of the checkdowns? How about that offense, right? Mason Fine's ability to protect the football might be what they prefer in a backup. And let's not pretend Shea Patterson is a gunslinger. You go back to college, Mason Fine wasn't exactly throwing it around the park. He had a 7.8 yard per attempt, I believe. And Shea Patterson had 8 yards per attempt. So more, don't get me wrong, it's more. He's throwing it a little bit deeper. But it's not as if he's blowing them out of the park and just throwing Hail Marys every play, right? Like, if Mason Fine isn't your guy, and I'm not convinced he is, then you've got to go out and find the next quarterback, right? And maybe that's a guy that you have on your roster right now in someone like Jack Cohn, but I don't
think know how closely you follow college football and the collegiate careers of a lot of guys who end up in the CFL. Personally, I kind of reject it because I think it's irrelevant what a guy did in college 6 years ago if he's been playing pro for 5-6 years. But for the record, Patterson has never won a backup job. Shea Patterson, playing at bigger programs, had a college quarterback rating of 143.1. Mason Fine, 140.7. So your argument is defeated in and of itself. And look, if the Riders just want Mason Fine to go out there for a game or two this year, potentially, and just tread water and take all the easy throws and throw all the checkdowns, just don't make mistakes, right? Play mistake-free football, then he's probably their guy. Is that a way to win games on any type of sustainable level? The answer is no. We saw that last year. They only started him 4 games. They gave Jake Dolagala the next 9. And obviously, the backup quarterback in Regina is always a popular guy because Regina, as we all know, is a CFL hotbed, and they love their backup quarterbacks. I'm not saying Patterson will be successful. All I'm saying is he probably deserves a shot to be successful. Mason Fine has had shots to be successful and, in my opinion, failed to take full advantage of those.
Speaking of quarterbacks who had shots to be successful,
that is a great transition. Johnny Manziel, you're a pro. That's a pro transition right there.
Johnny Football recently appeared on the Burtcast, a podcast hosted by comedian Burt Kreischer, during which he spoke highly of the CFL's talent level while also admitting that he manufactured his departure from the league. What was your take on
this? I will say, first off, I want to put it on the record that it irks me a little bit when any individual, this is not a Johnny Football criticism, this is a general criticism, they turn down opportunities to speak to journalists and answer real questions from reporters about particular issues, knowing that they might have tough questions asked of them, or they might be asked to discuss things that they're not super keen on discussing. But they will happily go on to a show hosted by a comedian who will lob softballs at them, and they can sit back and drink beer and swear and have fun. Now, do I understand the appeal of that? Of course. I might even do the same thing as Johnny Football or people of his ilk if I was in the same situation. That being said, as much as this was not a journalistic interview, this was two guys sitting around shooting the you-know-what, I did think it was a highly entertaining interview, and I would encourage our listeners, viewers, our readers to check out the interview in its full capacity. He talks about the CFL for almost 20 minutes, and that's not something that Johnny Manziel has done, to my knowledge, at any point since he played in the CFL in 2018 and was unceremoniously booted out of the league following that campaign. I believe he was officially forced to be released by the Alouettes in February of 2019, if I remember that detail correctly. But essentially what Manziel admits to is something that I think has been, you know, well speculated for a long time now, which is that he completely manufactured his departure from the league. When Johnny Manziel came to the CFL, he had previously been charged for assault. These charges were dropped. They stemmed from an incident with a then girlfriend. A plea deal was reached, during which I believe he had to agree to some counseling, agree to not be on parole, but be kind of surveilled by authorities for up to a year. And so with the CFL's domestic violence policy being what it was, he had to meet with Commissioner Randy Ambrosi and meet a certain set of conditions that have never been made public, at least until now. Johnny Manziel made it pretty clear that one of the conditions of his entry into the CFL was sobriety. He had to submit to alcohol and drug testing following the 2018 season. It's unclear if he was tested during the 2018 season, especially because as part of the interview, he admitted to every afternoon going to the keg to eat steaks and drink Crown Royal after practice ended at 1 o'clock. But essentially he said, you know, I was in it under a 2-year contract. There was no way to get out of it. This is, of course, before the CFL reintroduced the NFL window following the 2021 season. And Manziel said, yeah, the league sent an alcohol and drug tester to my house, and I was absolutely thrilled to hand him my sample, knowing full well that that was my ticket out of the league. And he even joked that you should send the urine sample straight to Randy Ambrosi, not even to the league, just send it to Randy Ambrosi himself, because his urine sample, again, jokingly, would smell so strongly of alcohol, you wouldn't even have to test it. So yeah, he admitted to manufacturing his exit from the league. This is something I always suspected was the case. I wrote a column about it after it happened. I went back and read it yesterday and I thought, ah, this is actually pretty good. Maybe I got a future in this writing thing. But, you know, at one point he seemed to be upset. Like he said, you know, the league used me for views. The league used me for attention. Well, first of all, yes, that is what professional entities do. The NFL uses Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce for views and clicks, too. The same way that Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce use the NFL to make tens of millions of dollars, right, and become world-famous athletes. Johnny Manziel used the CFL just as much as the CFL used Johnny Manziel, in my opinion. He made it very clear after not playing in 2016, after not playing in 2017, following a disastrous 2-year stint with the Browns, he wanted to get back to the NFL. At the time, there was only one option. That was Canada. He went to the CFL to try to get back to the NFL. It didn't work. The league used him. He used the league. It was the Tinder hookup of professional football. It was not a good relationship. It only lasted a short time. Johnny took his football, went back home, and the CFL has carried on merrily without him. That being said, again, good interview, highly entertaining, would recommend.
To me, what stuck out here is Manziel, clearly since he has retired and stepped away from football, has become a little bit more balanced, right? I think we've seen in some of the interviews he's done, he's gained a little bit of perspective. He's in a better place right now, maybe found a happy medium in his life, but he's still, I think, a highly intelligent and highly immature individual. And there are some things that he's just not taking responsibility for. It's quite clear that he should have never come up to the CFL, right? Correct. He was not finding joy in football. I think he's realized that now, that he wasn't finding it in the NFL, that an attempt to get back to the NFL wasn't going to find it. And he certainly didn't find it with the Hamilton Tiger Cats or the Montreal Alouettes. He was a deeply unhappy, I would argue, with the sobriety, things like that, probably a deeply ill person at the time. And this was not the right place for him to be in. However, the almost glee with which he discussed several of these aspects, the sending of the urine directly to Randy Ambrosi, certainly rubbed me the wrong way and didn't come across as a guy who has recognized his past failures and the effect that he has had on people. I also didn't love some of the ways he spoke about the league, as you alluded to. It's nice that he acknowledged that there were, I think the quote is, some effing monsters out here who would rip your male anatomy off. That's great. We all know that there's a high level of talent in the CFL, but the way he discussed that relationship, the league using him, I don't think is fully accurate, as you said. And I also didn't like some of the comments he made that weren't included in this article about the ratio and talking about that also in relation to race, which I think is a little bit dicey at times. And I have issues with that discussion as well. He just didn't come across as a mature individual, clearly someone who didn't appreciate the opportunity that this league afforded to him. And frankly, the CFL is better off that he took himself out of the league in the way that he did.
It should be noted that Bert Kreischer, whose comedy I've seen this individual before. I'm not super familiar with his comedy, but he is a party animal, self-described. Yes. He was featured in his big breakthrough was in 1997. He was featured in an article in Rolling Stone where he was named the top partier at the number one party school in the United States. He was attending Florida State. I think he was there for like 7 years. And reportedly, the film National Lampoon's Van Wilder is loosely based on him, or at least he served as the inspiration.
It's based for on the film. Article, yeah.
So that was the tone of the interview. This is like two guys who are well-documented partiers, love to drink, love to get out, love to be loud. You know, so I think that did kind of set the tone for the interview and some of the more crass things that Menzel said. I will also say, I think Menzel has a lot more self-awareness now. I think he is steadily maturing. He's now 31 years old. And I do think that he's a smart guy. He will get it figured out in time. Obviously, he didn't have it figured out back in 2018 when he was in the league. There's still some parts of it that he's figuring out. All in all, I mean, great for him for being complimentary to the CFL's talent level. That's what we all knew. I think people who follow the CFL know how good these players are. But I think it's good when an American audience hears that, especially from an American player who played at a very high level in college and was a first-round NFL draft pick, a guy who, I mean, some people correctly anticipated would not be a successful player in the NFL, but a guy who a number of other people thought was going to be a career, you know, perennial Pro Bowler, slinging it for whether it was the Cleveland Browns or maybe the Dallas Cowboys, of course, team not far from where he started in college at Texas A&M. So, you know, there were parts of it that I thought he articulated very well and accurately described the CFL. There's also some parts of it that, you know, details that he got wrong about the ratio, things like that. But all in all, I liked it. And I will also say, I have literally no appetite whatsoever to talk about Johnny Manziel. It was a one-year thing that, again, failed. It happened almost 10 years ago. Three Down Nation covered the you-know-what out of it at the time. I think correctly so, because it was a huge story. But since then, I have been hit with Johnny Manziel fatigue. I think our readers, viewers, listeners have also reached Johnny Manziel fatigue. But that being said, maybe Johnny Manziel fatigue has worn off for a lot of people. It's 2024, right? It's not like we're talking about this in 2021 or 2022. So I'm interested to see what the response to the article is as of this recording. It's only been up for a couple of hours, so we'll have to wait and see. But again, it would have been best if Johnny Manziel had done this interview with a reputable journalist where he could answer real questions about his time in the CFL. In the interim, though, this is a decent halfway point. And I will also say, I should note, Johnny Manziel loved Canada. Like he talked about living in Toronto while he was playing for the Tiger Cats, living in Old Port, Montreal while playing for the Alouettes. He loved the work day, which is obviously a lot less rigorous than being in the NFL. He loved seeing Canada. He loved his time up here. It was the football side of it that he did not care for. And that's why he manufactured his way out of the league. JC, the BC Lions have booked rap icon 50 Cent to perform at their home opener, marking the third year of their concert kickoff series. You'll be at the BC Lions' first game of the regular season for that home opener. Do you think this was the right choice for the team?
Look, I'm not the type of guy who listens to 50 Cent's music. I'm not the type of guy who listened to LL Cool J's music last year, but that does not play into my analysis of this type of booking. I think from an entertainment standpoint and from a volume or a notoriety of the act, you really can't get much bigger and much better than 50 Cent, right? This is a guy who's got nearly 13 million followers out there on Twitter. He's a guy who is known by an entire generation. Even people like me who don't listen to his music know who he is. He's going to pack people into that stadium. People are excited to watch him perform. I would argue he may even be a bigger draw than the two acts they've had the last 2 years in LL Cool J and One Republic. I'm interested to see if the numbers bear that out. Now, there has been some commentary on social media that I think needs to be addressed that I actually agree with to an extent, in that 50 Cent has a history of some allegations of, you know, abuse, domestic violence against women. We are in a climate right now, particularly in the CFL, but in the world in general, where that is not tolerated. We're coming off the Chad Kelly scandal. Is bringing in someone with that reputation a bit hypocritical by the BC Lions? Is it the right choice? Personally, it's not something I would have done. And I think any criticism that people want to lob at the club for that, I think is fair. But ultimately, people as a whole, music lovers, rap lovers, adore 50 Cent's music, and he's going to be larger than that controversy. Whether that's ethically or morally right, I would say not, but he is going to pack people into the stadium, and that's inevitably what the Lions want.
I think that from a demographic standpoint, the Lions hit it out of the park. Like, when you look at, and there's not a lot of published research about this, but like Angus Reid did a poll. By the way, for Google's sake, I really wish that the Angus Reid Institute didn't share a name with one of the best centers in CFL history, because when you Google Angus Reid CFL looking for polling results, you inevitably get results about Angus Reid, the player. So maybe we could officially petition Angus Reid to change his legal name, or we could ask the Angus Reid Institute to change its name. I'm not sure. Maybe both. We'll get them both to change their names. But in all seriousness, you look at the research, and it's pretty clear that the CFL has an age problem. According to this poll that they did in 2023, talking to 835 subjects, people over the age of 55, when asked, when thinking about football, which of these two professional leagues do you prefer? 48% said CFL, 30% said NFL, and 21% said that they had no preference or enjoyed both equally. That changes dramatically when you look at different age ranges. 18 to 34, it's 58% NFL, only 29% CFL. And it's essentially the same in the 35 to 54 age demographic. It's 56% NFL, 25% CFL. Now, that is male only, but on the female side, the proportions are essentially the exact same. Over the age of 55, it's 48% CFL, 25% NFL, but 18 to 34, it's 52% NFL, 32% CFL, and between the ages of 35 and 54, it's 52% NFL and 29% CFL. In other words, the CFL has to do something to bring in people, obviously between the ages of 18 and 54, but one would think close to the middle of that demographic, right? People between the ages of 30 and 40. These are people who are more likely to have young kids who they could bring to games with them. Obviously, teams want that. I do also notice that in the BC Lions ticket sales, especially in the upper bowl, which they've opened for this game, they offer a $15 youth seat, which I think is very clever. Some of the upper bowls tickets go as much as, I think it's $70 for adults, but some of them are as cheap as $20. So if you're a mother or a father with a son or a daughter, theoretically, you could have a night on the town, the two of you, for less than $40. What can you do for less than 40 bucks in Vancouver? I don't think you can even walk down the street for less than 40 bucks in Vancouver. So that's a good deal. And I also think this is the type of thing that will bring out that key, we'll call it 30 to 40 demographic. I don't want to alienate those under the age of 30 or those over the age of 40. But, you know, that seems to be the heart of it. Now, I fall into that category. I'm in my 30s, and I can attest I was 12 when Get Rich or Die Trying came out. And every suburban white kid I went to school with suddenly had super baggy jeans with the sweatband, wanting to be 50 Cent. You could not walk down the hall without seeing just a flock of kids suddenly overnight believing that they were a true PIMP, as he described himself, on that album, which sold something preposterous. I think it was 12 million copies worldwide back when people bought music. So I think it, from a demographic standpoint, I understand your criticism, JC, but to me, this is a slam dunk. From a demographic standpoint, LL Cool J, I think, appealed to not an old crowd, but a slightly older crowd. For instance, I didn't grow up with LL Cool J. He was really big in the 90s. I think that 50 Cent perfectly hits the demographic that the Lions covet. And this would have cost Amar Doman a lot of money. You cannot get 50 Cent out to do a show for pocket change. So full credit to him and the rest of his team for getting this done. It's a very, very cool opportunity.
I think the one last element of this that I have also seen floated out online is if Amar Doman is out here getting 50 Cent for the home opener, the Grey Cup's in Vancouver this year. I got an email just the other day. Randy Ambrosi will be in town next Monday to announce something regarding halftime entertainment for the Grey Cup. Do we know if he's announcing the act, if it's something else? I don't know. It's not specified in the email, but he'll be in town. If Amar Doman's getting 50 Cent for the home opener, what do you think he's doing to try and get the biggest possible act out for Grey Cup? I think we should be excited about what the potential announcements could be down the line.
Do you think it's safe to speculate that it'll be better than 2 years ago when half of the Florida Georgia line was in Regina? Do you think?
Yes, I think it's safe to say that we will be better than than half of Florida Georgia line.
Half the Florida Georgia line. They just had the Georgia. That's it. Just half of it. Just half of it. It's now time for Hodges' heritage moment. On this day in 2018, Canadian offensive lineman Laurent Duvernay-Tardif graduated from McGill University with a Doctor of Medicine and Master of Surgery. The native of Mont-Saint-Hilaire, Quebec, became the only active NFL player to graduate from medical school, something that had only been achieved by three retired players. The Chiefs would win Super Bowl 54 less than 2 years later, with Dr. Duvernay-Tardif starting at right guard. The now 33-year-old retired from professional football in September 2023 following a 9-year run with the Chiefs and New York Jets, during which he won the Lou Marsh Trophy and Sports Illustrated Sportsperson of the Year for his decision to temporarily step away from the game to help fight the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. JC, what do you think of when you hear the name Laurent Duvernay-Tardif?
I think of one of the most iconic Canadian athletes of my generation for all the right reasons, not just for what he was able to accomplish on the field, not just for the incredible status of being a player drafted out of a U Sports program, which, as we all know, is so difficult to do, but for what he did as a person and as a medical professional at a time of great crisis for this entire world and for his country and his province. I thought it was a selfless act. I thought it was true leadership that we very rarely see in professional sports, to be able to sacrifice that money to be able to help others. I have so much respect for LDT. And I would also like to add, you mentioned three previous players that were able to accomplish this after retirement. Well, another one of those is Canadian as well. So of the four medical doctors who have played in the NFL, two of them are Canadian, the other being JP Darche, the fantastic long snapper who had a longtime NFL career. His son will be coming down the CFL draft pipeline in a few years, Zach Darche at Penn. So keep an eye out for that as well.
Yeah, Laurent Duvernay-Tardif is a hero, in my opinion, for what he did. I mean, he forewent a great opportunity in the NFL to work, I believe, as an orderly. Like, he was not doing, sometimes people with this level of privilege, you know, they take a cushy job where it might sound good on paper, but they spend a lot of time sitting in boardrooms with executives pretending to do stuff when the people on the ground are the ones doing all the work. That is not the case with Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. He was on the ground in scrubs working with sick people. He chose to do it when the alternative was making millions of dollars playing in the NFL. And that type of sacrifice is phenomenal. This is somebody who truly has his heart and his mind in the right place, and I think the future is extremely bright for Mr. Tardif with whatever he chooses to do with the rest of his life, whether it is practice medicine, whether it is philanthropy. He's also worked as a reporter for the CBC, which is nice to know that not only was this gentleman, who was born in the same year as me, a much better athlete and much smarter, he's also doing my job and probably doing it better than I can, which is not at all hard on my ego. And not bothersome at all when I think about it in detail. Now, on a completely unrelated note, let's move on. It's time for the 3-minute drill. JC, the Toronto Argonauts have signed quarterback John Matocha out of Colorado School of Mines. Do you think he could be the next great CFL quarterback?
Look, I've not watched the John Matocha. We may have found another name.
Loyola. Matocha. Loyola. Matocha.
Matocha. I've not watched the film, but the numbers from college are impressive. And what I will give credit here, Toronto Argonauts have a bit of a shaky quarterback situation, right, with Chad Kelly out. They brought in a veteran in Nick Arbuckle. I didn't love that move. But now you bring in somebody who could maybe be that next guy, like we talked about in the Mason Fine situation. I love when teams sign exciting quarterback prospects, and this appears to be one of those.
I think that John Matocha should marry one of Danny Machocha's daughters, and then they can hyphenate, so it'll be Matocha Machocha.
That'll be a hell of a wedding. Weston Dressler told The Waggle that he's undecided about which team to represent in the Hall of Fame, Saskatchewan or Winnipeg. Which club do you most associate with Dressler?
There's only one answer to this. It's not even really a question, and that is the Saskatchewan Roughriders. Yes, Weston Dressler had a couple of good years with the Bombers after leaving Ryderville, but he is a Saskatchewan Roughrider in my mind, and I think in the minds of virtually anybody who watched him play in the CFL.
There's really only one answer to this question, because it's not a question. It's neither. You don't pick a team when you go to the CFL Hall of Fame. I don't know why the Waggle was even asking this question.
I think the reason they asked it actually is because after Enoch Buamba retired, who co-hosts the show, I asked him, you played for four different teams. You won your only Grey Cup with Toronto. You won your only Most Outstanding Canadian with Montreal. I forget what he accomplished, or maybe he won it with Saskatchewan. I can't remember. But anyways, he accomplished something different. Right? He was the first overall pick of the draft with Winnipeg, and he kind of said, oh, that's a good question. So it's possible he just borrowed my question, which, by the way, he's welcome to do, because I'm sure that I borrowed that question unknowingly from somebody who's asked it previously. So I think that's why this conversation was had, but I can't speak for Enoch. Université de Montréal quarterback. Wow, a lot of my bad French accent in the podcast today. My apologies to the province of Quebec and half the province of New Brunswick. Jonathan Senecal has been named a finalist for U Sports Athlete of the Year. Do you think he deserves to win?
I can't say that because I don't know anything about any of the other athletes or sports nominated. However, Jonathan Senecal's accomplishments last year in football speak for themselves. He would be a deserving winner. I just don't know about all the people that he's going up against. Veteran defensive back Luches Purifoy wasn't happy with tensions boiling over in Edmonton during a recent practice, saying, quote, that S-H-I-T can't happen, close quote. Do you think the Elks lack discipline?
Only he didn't spell it out. He said the word. Oh, language. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, at the end of the day, tensions boil over in practice, especially during preseason, but guys are getting sick of hitting each other over and over and over again. To me, this is a non-issue unless it actually translates to the regular season. I'll say it again. This team took two penalties in their preseason debut, which obviously any team would be pretty thrilled with. If you take two penalties a game, you're going to be by far and away the least penalized team in the year. So hopefully that translates. In a story you broke, JC, the Hamilton Tiger Cats have signed Canadian defensive end David Menard. Is that a good move for the folks in Steeltown?
It's a fantastic move for Hamilton. David Menard, I think, is one of the most underrated players in the CFL. I think he got overvalued a little bit after those breakout 8 and 9 sack seasons where he was nominated for most outstanding Canadian, but consistently he is a guy who can play inside. He can play outside. He can give you 5 sacks a season. He can give you the hard reps. He was one of the most valuable players for the BC Lions for a number of years. He sort of aged out of that role and they brought in somebody like Christian Covington. But the Ticats, who need, I think, to have an established Canadian starter on the defensive line, Menard is a perfect person to pair with Mason Bennett. Saskatchewan Roughriders superfan Don Pagoda showed off his riderized 1988 Lincoln Town Car at training camp in Saskatoon. Hodge, did you see those pictures?
I did see the pictures. Our very own Justin Dunk was able to snap those pictures. I believe it was in Saskatoon while the Riders were still there opening training camp. And the Lincoln Town Car will always have a soft spot in my head, my heart, because my grandmother and grandfather owned one when I was a kid. And I remember taking trips on that car. And I'm sure it's not quite as big as I remember it because I was a child at the time. But that car was routinely referred to as the boat in years that were to come because it was a massive, massive vehicle for what it really had to be. So I really enjoyed that article. The BC Lions made a round of cuts on Monday, including running back Taquan Mizell and quarterback Dakota Prukop. Did either of those moves surprise you?
They didn't really. I mean, Prukop was the more surprising of the two because I thought he was going to be penciled in as the short yardage guy. Clearly, the Lions have different plans there. But Taquan Mizell's days were numbered the second this team signed William Stanback. And essentially, they ended when he showed up to training camp lighter than he was last year after being asked to gain weight in the offseason. He just didn't fit the mold that this team was trying to go with. Next year, they added two bigger body running backs behind standback rookies who can compete for a PR spot. There was no room for Mizell's scat back style anymore. Hodge, the Blue Bombers cut quarterback Eric Berrier this past week and replaced him with Georgia State alumnus Darren Granger. Was that a surprise?
No, because I have eyeballs and I watched the first preseason game that the Bombers had, during which Eric Berrier was terrible, throwing 2 interceptions. That being said, it was a surprise that he was unable to translate the tremendous collegiate success he had at Eastern Washington, given the fact that that program previously has produced guys like Matt Nichols, Vernon Adams Jr., and Bo Levi Mitchell. So obviously it's tough, right? You can't just draw a line and say, well, this guy was good in college, he's going to be good in the CFL. Some guys need time to help that translated. And who knows, maybe Eric Berrier gets picked up and he goes on has an amazing CFL career somewhere else. Might happen. Was not happening in Winnipeg. Eric Upton, who won 5 straight Grey Cups with Edmonton, has passed away at the age of 71. How will you remember him?
I'll remember him as a champion. Not only was he a member of those 5 straight Grey Cup winning teams, a starter on that offensive line, and eventually a captain for, I believe, the last 1 or 2. Well, he was also a champion in college. He helped lead the Ottawa GGs to a Vanier Cup in 1975, a tremendous victory for that program. So a guy who won at every level he played at, that says something about the caliber of player that Eric Upton was. Tiger Cats head coach Scott Milanovic threatened to find new players if his squad can't avoid taking penalties on special teams. Did he overstep?
No, I don't think he did, because Scott Milanovic is a bit of an old school coach. He will call it like he sees it, and I respect him for that. He's not somebody where you have to sit around wondering, I wonder what's on Scott Milanovic's mind. Like, he will let you know, and you know, he, I think, is under some pressure here in Steeltown. Yeah, he is technically a first-year head coach there, but he's been a head coach previously elsewhere, and I don't think there's a lot of patience in Steeltown for a rebuild. This is a team that, you know, underwent significant changes this past offseason, and I think wants to hit the ground running, especially with an older veteran quarterback at the helm that the Ticats have repeatedly reiterated is expected to return to his previous form. Of course, I'm talking about Bo Levi Mitchell. So Scott Milanovic doesn't have time to waste on guys who are taking stupid penalties on special teams, evidently. The Lions have released former first-round pick Daniel Joseph, who they signed this offseason after waiting 3 years to get him. Is that a surprise?
It's not a surprise, though it is a disappointment. I thought Daniel Joseph was a really solid prospect coming out of the CFL draft. Obviously put up great numbers his final year at NC State. But I saw him as a little too stiff to be a CFL edge rusher. I thought he needed to move inside, much like the Lions did last year with Francis Bemmy, their first-round pick. But instead, he got a late NFL opportunity, and then after that, drug his feet, went to the XFL, played backup minutes, didn't see the field a ton, didn't develop into a CFL player like he should have. And once he arrived this year, there just really wasn't a space for him the way that Lions roster is constructed, specifically if he wanted to play defensive end. Unfortunately, busting as a prospect seems to run in the family here, because this is the brother of Faith Akakiti, who was a first overall pick for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers a number of years ago and only lasted one season with this club. Daniel Joseph, unfortunately, follows that same path here. The Toronto Argonauts have signed star return specialist Janarian Grant following a four-year run with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, during which he scored 8 return touchdowns over 41 games. Is that a big boost for the Boatmen?
I mean, Grant is 30, and he only played 8 games last season due to injury, so I hesitate to call this a massive, massive boost for the Argonauts, but there's no denying that Janarian Grant has been sensational since reporting to the CFL in 2019, and I'm really excited to see what he has left in the tank. The Calgary Stampeders have officially ruled out Malik Henry for the season after he suffered a patella tendon injury in practice on Tuesday. Is that a big blow for the Stamps?
Look, it's a blow for the Stamps. I think it's a bigger blow for the player. Obviously, Henry was coming back after missing all except 3 weeks of last season with an Achilles injury. He did all the right work in the offseason to try and get back to form to become the all-star player he was in 2022, and that's not going to happen. So your heart just breaks for the guy. The Stampeders obviously were relying on him to be that deep threat, but they had to make do without him last year. I think they'll have some players on the roster who at least can step in, albeit not at the caliber that Malik Henry brings to the table. Hamilton has brought back receiver Stephen Dunbar Jr. following a brief stint in the UFL. The big body target had 1,000 yards with the Ticats in 2022 before bolting for a big money deal with the Edmonton Elks. Is that a good move?
I think it is, especially with training camp sensation Justin McGriff suffering a second consecutive season-ending injury. I think he was expected to do big things in Tiger Town. That will obviously not happen now. And I think that Dunbar is a bit of an example of the fact that the grass is not always greener, right? He worked out great with the Ticats in 2022. I don't know if he was offered a big money extension in Steeltown. Obviously, the Ticats were significantly outbid by the Elks, which precipitated his move to Edmonton. However, sometimes when you got a good thing going on, you just got a good thing going on, and you should stick where you are, because Dunbar was not very productive with the Elks last year, went to the UFL, got cut. I'm glad that he's back in Steeltown, where apparently he's a very productive player, and the Ticats needed to add some fuel to that receiving core, I think. So on that note, we thank you as always for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, please make sure to tag JC and myself on social media. If you hated the show, tag Justin Dunk. please join us next week. Next week, JC, our last episode before the regular season. Let's go.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.